have you here. Thanks for joining us, and I'm going to turn the floor over to you.
Thank you. You see quite a few familiar faces around the room, but also some new ones. So some of you probably don't know me. I was matched with Charlie in November of 2019 and came out to train with him, well, actually October of 2019. We went home on Halloween that year.
Yeah.
And so I've been with Charlie for, almost 3 years. Katie asked me to come today to talk about how does my disability impact me. And so I've got a few notes here because otherwise I'll go off on complete tangents. And just so the short answer to how does my disability impact me is really easy. It just makes everything more difficult. But, you know, you asked me to come and speak to you. I could have told you those, three words in or four words in an email. So you want a kind of a longer answer. So. So first of all, what is my disability? Because I think that's relevant to understanding how it impacts me. So I have multiple sclerosis, or usually abbreviated to MS. It's a autoimmune disease where the immune system attacks the central nervous system, which is the optic nerve, the brain, and the spinal cord. Covering all of those nerve cells, there's something called myelin, which is kind of like the plastic coating you get on electrical wires. The immune system attacks that myelin, strips it off, and just like with your electrical wires, if that plastic coating's not there, you can end up with short circuits or whatever. So with MS, basically the same thing happens. The nerve signals are not getting between parts of the brain to the eyes or to the down the spinal cord to all of the other parts of your body. Now, bear in mind, pretty much every organ in your body has some level of control due to the nervous system. And so as a result, MS can really impact anywhere in your body and have all sorts of symptoms. Most obvious ones are when it starts affecting what are called gross motor, like the legs and the arms. So for me, obviously, mostly the most obvious symptom to you guys is that I can't walk. But there, for everyone with MS, there's a million other symptoms that everyone suffers from that you wouldn't necessarily be able to know just from looking at them. So the vast majority of people with MS do not use a wheelchair. They may use a walking stick or something, but most of them are still fully mobile. And so it comes under this idea of invisible disabilities where, you know, you might park in a disabled parking spot because your MS means you can't walk all that far. But when you get out the car, you look like a young, healthy 20 or 30-something woman. That's the most people are first affected, more women and in their 20s and 30s when you first start to see it. So, you know, there's the vast majority of people with MS, you wouldn't know they had MS to look at them. And that's something to bear in mind with many different disabilities is that, you know, just because you can't see it on the outside, people might be suffering a lot of other symptoms. So since it can affect anywhere in the body, really the only organs it doesn't affect are the heart, the liver, and the kidneys, because all of those get on doing what they're doing, whether they're told to or not by the nervous system. So some examples of symptoms you can suffer from are spasticity. That means your muscles go stiff, kind of like having a Charlie horse, but it doesn't go away. And it's, you know, it can be quite painful and it can make it hard to walk. Pain and itching in different parts of the body. Fatigue, basically that means for an average person walking up the stairs, you get to the top. Maybe if it's a really big flight of stairs, you feel a little out of breath. For somebody with MS, the fatigue can mean that those muscles tire out after two or three steps and you literally cannot take another step. Most common symptom which leads to diagnosis in people under 30 is what's called optic neuritis, inflammation of the optic nerve, which affects color vision in particular. It can also cause sudden blindness, not complete loss of vision, but very blurry vision to the point of it being considered blindness, and double vision. And then any sort of symptoms in the the limbs and the hands, loss of dexterity, loss of strength in all of your muscles, a lot of different things. One thing that's particularly specific to MS is sensitivity to heat, which means anytime the body is heated up, either by doing exercise, going out on a hot day, being in a hot room, all of the symptoms suddenly get a whole lot worse. So for instance, if I went out on a hot day, I would wear a vest full of ice packs to keep my core temperature down, because otherwise I would pretty much turn into a bowl of jelly and slide out of my chair pretty much, because I would have no strength in any of my muscles. So because it can affect anywhere on the nervous system, and for any individual with MS, that attack on the myelin can happen anywhere. Every individual with MS has different symptoms and different severity. And so it's kind of sometimes referred to as the snowflake disease. It also makes it really hard to diagnose, because the symptoms can be so different for everyone, and also can come and go in the early stages of the disease. Okay, so that's a bit of background about MS. So back to how does it impact me? Well, when I first became a wheelchair user, or most of the time outside, it's not like one day you suddenly go from walking to sitting in a wheelchair. It's a gradual process. You start to use a wheelchair for longer distances or places where you know there won't be anywhere to sit down, and then eventually you get to the point where you're taking less and less steps and using a wheelchair more and more. But when I really started to notice was how much the world is basically stacked against me. So I can list hundreds of things I encounter every day that make my life more difficult, but here's a few. Sidewalks full of cracks or tree roots that are poking up, sidewalks very unlevel. Get to a corner, find there's no curb cut, or the curb cut has got a big, does not go smoothly down to the road. Trash day, I hate. Everyone puts their trash bins in the middle of the sidewalk, so I've got, have to go down into the street, up the street, and back onto the thing. When you're in a store, particularly smaller stores, where the racks are so close together, I can't get around them. Restaurants with high top or only booth seating, no use to me. Biggest issue everywhere we go is the lack of or unavailable accessible bathrooms. So, and another one is in the winter, lack of snow. People who snow shovel, don't snow shovel, shovel one snow shovel wide, any of those things. It basically means I cannot get out my house in the winter because I can't rely on being able to get where I want to go in my chair. So as a result, you can become somewhat homebound unless you're relying on other people to get you where you need to go during the winter. So that really leads on to what I want to say were the two biggest ways that it impacts me. And the first one is loss of independence. And the second one is loss of spontaneity in my life. So for example, a loss of independence. I go to a store, they don't have one of those nice pads on the outside. I can't get the door open. I rely on somebody else to be able to get me into the store. Once I'm in the store, can't reach stuff on the top shelf. Again, I've got to rely on somebody else to reach those things for me. Getting out and about, I no longer drive, so I rely on other people for rides to get places. So again, loss of independence, loss of, I can't just think, oh, I'll pop out to the store because I need to find if I can get that. There's at least in the Boston area, there's what's called the ride, which is a paratransit service where you can have them come and pick you up and take you where you need to go. But you have to book that the day before. So you can't just call them up and say, can I get a ride? Now, there are Uber WAV. WAV stands for wheelchair accessible vehicles. But of course, you know, the number of Ubers out there compared to the number of ones that are actually running accessible vehicles, they're very small. So sometimes you call them up and, you know, usually an Uber will take, at least in the Boston area, can pick you up in 5 minutes. If you're waiting for a wheelchair van, you might be waiting an hour just because. So you can't even rely on that as being an alternative form of transportation. And in terms of spontaneity, for instance, whenever we go out thinking about going out for dinner to a restaurant that we've never been to, I have to call up ahead of time, ask if they have an accessible entrance even. Many, particularly in this area, although the American with Disabilities Act has been in force for, 30 plus years at this point, many older buildings are what's called grandfathered in, which means they don't have to make any accessible modifications unless they're doing a complete renovation of the building. So they get around that, which means many restaurants might have a step to get in the front door. And even if they I can get in the front door, they may or may not have a bathroom which is truly accessible for me. I can't go out to dinner if I don't know that I can use the bathroom. If I'm booking a hotel room, I have to call them. I can't just go on Expedia and click hotel room. I have to call up, ask them, do you have an accessible room? Does it have an accessible bathtub or a roll-in shower? Because I can't use the bathtub, which is considered acceptable as in an accessible hotel room. I've got to figure out the public transit ahead of time. We went to London 4 or 5 years ago now, and ahead of time I was sat there with a map of the subway system ticking off which of the stations had elevators to make sure we could get to the places we needed to go. And you can't just call on friends, because pretty much every house in New England has 3 or 4 steps to get in the front door. And even if you can get in the front door, you probably can't get into the bathroom. So again, you've got to plan meeting friends out somewhere ahead of time. So or no spontaneity in my life these days. But in some ways, all of those things I've got used to and I can get around. So in some ways, the biggest way that my disability impacts me is how I'm treated or seen by other people, or maybe not seen in many cases. So I know you're talking about ableism this month, so I just wanted to give you a few examples of where I've encountered ableism, which in most cases really just comes to people being thoughtless and stuff coming out of their mouth before they even think about what they're saying. So we were out for dinner one day last year. When we first started going out for dinner, we hadn't been out anywhere for over a year. And last summer we were like, okay, we feel comfortable going to a restaurant with outdoor seating. So Doug and I went, we got dressed up, we went out for a nice meal. We're sitting at the table and we started interacting a little bit with our server, because it turned out he was also from the UK. So we had some things in common. And some point during the meal, I went to the bathroom and I came back and we finished the meal and we got in the car and Doug said to me, you know what he said to me while you were in the bathroom? He said to me, oh, do you mind me asking what happened to her? And first of all, you know, to say something like that, but to say it to my husband while I was in the bathroom, that was for me. And I said, it's lucky you didn't tell me before we left the restaurant, because he would have not been getting a tip. So, you know, another time we were coming out of the theater in Worcester, and this was when I had Charlie, and a complete stranger patted me on the head and said, go on, you're doing so well. And I just turned around and I said, excuse me, I'm not a toddler. But, you know, again, thoughtlessness, really. Would you pat a grown adult on the head? And often, I've encountered this at airports, we've been going through security and Doug will be walking behind me and they'll look at Doug and they'll say, can she stand? Not even make eye contact with me. One time when I was, at this time it was earlier on in my disease, and I was walking with a cane, but I had a disabled badge for my car and I was still working. I taught at Wentworth Institute of Technology. I taught physics and math there. And I'm walking into the building on a snowy, icy day, and the main parking lot for all the faculty was about a quarter of a mile walk up the road from where our building was. But because I had the disabled parking spot, they had a few right outside the building for people with the parking placard. And we're walking into the building and one of my colleagues said, oh, you're so lucky to get the good parking. Man, I'm feeling really darn lucky right now, I thought. Just last week, we went out to dinner for my son's 14th birthday. We found out the accessible bathroom in the restaurant was closed, so we had to leave early without dessert because, you know, I couldn't cross my legs that long. Often you'll go into places and they think because the accessible bathroom is big, it's a great place for them to use for storage, or the hallway down to the accessible bathroom is blocked with, you know, stuff used for storage. One thing that's quite hard often is navigating through a crowd because you're not at people's eye level. They don't notice you. I've actually got I put a little flashing light on Charlie's vest because he gets stepped on if I'm not careful because people just don't look down and they don't see us there. So another one that you see all the time is people pulling into the accessible parking spaces, and they'll be like, oh, it's just here for a minute. Well, if it's the minute I need to park there, you know, or people wait in them, oh, my wife's just gone run into the store. I'm not parked, I'm just waiting here. Apparently that's okay. And also blocking the hashed area next to the accessible parking spaces, because those are the ones, particularly if you have a wheelchair van, you need the space to get the ramp down and get out of the van. If that space is blocked, you either can't get in or out of your van. Apparently it's if there's no other parking spots, that's fair game, so. So how does Charlie make life a little less hard? Well, the first thing that was surprising to me when I brought him home is Charlie does the vast majority of his work for me and his tasks for me in our house. It was, you know, when you see, I was like, oh, service dog, he'll be able to go everywhere with me. This will be awesome. He can do all these things. But actually, most of what he does is at home. For instance, as a wheelchair user, one of the most taxing things for me to do is get in and out of my chair. Now, I don't want to be sitting in this all day, just like you don't stand all day. If you want to watch TV, I like to slouch on the sofa just like everybody else does. So that means I have to transfer out of my chair onto the sofa. Well, the number of times I've done that and then realized I've left the remote control on the other side of the room. So it used to be, I'd be like, okay, I guess I'm not watching TV then. Now, Charlie can do that for me. Go and grab it or whatever else I've left out of reach. Glasses, phone he gets for me a lot. In fact, anytime I'm more than 6 feet from my phone now, he pretty much just brings it to me.
He knows how tethered we are.
Well, he also knows he gets a treat for it.
Yeah, that's true. That helps.
So also, leaning down to the floor, that's actually, for a wheelchair user, one of the times which can be most risky for us, leaning down to the floor, that's when we could fall out of our chair. Now, if I end up on the floor, I'm stuck there. I either have to, if Doug's in work, I have to call him home to come help me up, or you have to call 911 and get the paramedic or the fire service to come out. And I can tell you, the actual firefighters are not nearly as good looking as they are on the calendar. And it's kind pretty embarrassing having, you know, the emergency services turn up at your house just to help you get up off the floor. So you'd rather not do that. So again, even if it's not something I've left out of reach, but if I'm in my chair and I drop something, I can just have Charlie pick it up for me. The other thing that he does, which has really made a huge difference to my independence, is being able to close my front door. And this sounds like such a small thing, but I come out the front door in my chair, I've got to lean all the way around, somehow back to get the handle to pull it closed. That's really quite difficult. And as a result, I pretty much wouldn't go out unless I knew I had somebody to close the door behind me. Well, now I've got Charlie. I just go out the door, tell him the command, he's got the tug rope on the door, he pulls it closed, I quickly lock it and we're done. And that makes such a huge difference. So, those are the two biggest things I think that Charlie does for me, which makes a difference. Another thing which is kind of funny is that, as I was saying before about how people would talk over my head to Doug, now they still don't make eye contact with me. They want to say hi to Charlie. Mm-hmm. So I still get ignored, but you know, I feel like a dog's a step up from
my Aww, he's pretty cute.
But
I know I am.
But I think the real thing is that when I go out with Charlie, it gives me the confidence that if I do drop something, he can pick it up for me. If I, you know, it means that I go out on my own a lot more than I did before because I've just got that confidence of having him there to help me. And he's good company too. I don't know, when I had little kids and I was still walking, I pushed the stroller, I liked pushing. You'd feel like you had a sense of purpose to go for a walk. And then once they got beyond their stroller years, it kind of felt weird to me, just going for a walk by myself somehow. Mm. Now I'm out with Charlie. We walk 5 to 6 miles most days, as long as it's either not too hot or too cold. We live near the river, the Charles River in Watertown. And we just, you know, out and about, seeing, you know, enjoying the outside world, which I don't think I would do if I didn't have him with me. So that was all I had notes to say to you guys, but I'm happy to continue the discussion if anyone has questions or comments or whatever.
Naomi, I remember you telling me when you were here for your class with Charlie that you couldn't even be a client at the vet closest to your house
because
it wasn't handicapped accessible.
Yeah, when I came home with Charlie and I was looking for vets, the two vets that I'd been recommended, two of them both had steps to get in the front door. In fact, one of them, I called up and I said, do you have a ramp? And they said, yes. And then they called back a few minutes later and said, but actually there's two steps to get up to the ramp.
We have a ramp.
It was really designed, I think, for animals.
They had it so if they had older dogs who couldn't climb up mm-hmm. the 6 steps to get in, they could just have to do 2 and then go up the ramp. But it all worked out fine because the vet I found is absolutely awesome. They don't have any exam tables. They have dog beds in every room, and you bring your dog in, and they get down on the floor. And he must be the only dog that cries when you get to the vet because he's so excited to go in.
Seriously. What made you first consider getting a service dog? What was the impetus?
I don't know if there was one particular thing. I'd certainly seen stuff about them online, and I was still working when we first started thinking about it, and so we had thoughts about getting a dog in the past, but it never felt fair when we were both working full time. So when I started, my disability started to get worse, but I was still working. We were like, oh, well, if we got a service dog, he could come to work with me. He wouldn't be home all day by himself, and he would be able to help me and do all the things that I was just talking about. And so we looked around to see the different organizations in New England, and quite honestly, needs was so cream of the crop. It wasn't any kind of, you know, there was no competition that I would go with Needs. The standards you have here and the, you know, everything I read about you guys online, it seemed like that if you want a service dog, you go to Needs. But
I guess I don't really have a question. It's more of like, am I understanding things correctly? That obviously Charlie is able to help in so many ways, but there are also, like, even with Charlie, you still have to call the restaurant ahead of time to see if the bathroom's accessible. Like, there's still many things.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you could get the dog to do that.
Oh, okay, yeah, dial up the phone.
We'll add that to the training.
Yeah.
Phone calls.
Yeah, I mean, Charlie makes my life easier, but he isn't, you know, he can't fix everything because
there's a
world's
lot of,
still
like,
stacked against me.
Infrastructure that's still not helpful.
Even a needs dog can't make phone
calls. Yeah, yeah.
Well, cope with kids or a husband.
Depending on the day.
Yeah, he can't help my sons with their homework.
It's funny. Sue, I almost hit reply to your email and be like, information about her sons is outdated because her boys are both older.
They're 14 and 16 now.
Mm. You're in the thick of teens. That's, oh. I have one of each of those. It's exciting times.
Following Naomi on Facebook is pretty entertaining because most of her stories are about her two cool teenage boys.
Yeah. I call them hashtag grouchy teens.
Well said.
To be fair, though, they are really good kids. They help me make dinner almost every day because my kitchen is not accessible. We just had a whole new kitchen done right before my disability got worse, so our kitchen is not very accessible at all. So they're up at the counter cooking. In fact, at the beginning of the pandemic, I started doing HelloFresh 2 days a week because I was getting so, like, burnt out of figuring out what to eat for dinner every day. And I'll be honest, before the pandemic, we were pretty lazy. We quite often order takeout or go out to eat. So having to suddenly come up with something for dinner 7 days a week, I was getting burned out. So I started getting HelloFresh 2 days a week. And I was like, you boys, you're not in school. You're not doing anything. You're going to help cook this. I'm just going to sit here. By about the third week, I was banned from the kitchen because I was too bossy. So now they still want... almost 3 years later, still make the HelloFresh 2 days a week.
I did the same thing. I didn't get banned from the kitchen, unfortunately. 7 days a week? Are you kidding me? I can't do that.
Yeah. Actually, I think being too bossy and getting banned from the kitchen. Fabulous.
Sounds good, but practical application. So I'm curious because you do have these, and your boys were young, I think, when, you know, around the start of your disability, you know, as a spouse, you sign up for better, for worse, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But as a kid, you know, I think that there's an impact there on your family that obviously is unexpected. But how did the whole family sort of adapt to your disability over time? I mean, certainly you added Charlie, but...
I can say Doug has 100% stepped up to the plate because we're both astrophysicists by training, and he was, I would say, your typical physicist, that he was great at doing his science, but, you know, the real world stuff of making dinner and things like that on a daily basis, he was not that interested in or good at, and he's really, he you know.
I'm still not very good. But I will... I'm unfortunately not allowed to ban Naomi from the kitchen.
But my two boys, when my disability first started becoming apparent, they were, I think, around 7 and 9 or 8 and 10. And one thing was, right from the beginning, I was 100% honest with them because I felt like, you know, that if they saw, you know, me starting to struggle in different ways, and I didn't tell them what was going on, they were probably going to think worse, right? And what one thing about MS is, it's progressive, but it's not terminal. You don't die from MS. So the first thing I said to them was, look, you know, I have this disease. This is what it's called. I'm going to, you know, lose my mobility in different ways and have these different symptoms, but I'm not dying. And that's all we kept it at. And since then, they've pretty much, you know, taken it in their stride because that's what they've lived with since they were basically little kids. And so it's funny, if we go somewhere, they'll be the ones checking in all the car windscreens to check if everyone's got the disabled parking placards and things like that. And I actually think kids are almost better than adults when it comes to disability. I remember I started using a scooter to pick my sons up, like a mobility scooter, to pick my sons up from school. And I was like, said to Cameron, look, you know, are you sure you want me to come up to the school? I don't want you to be embarrassed. And he's like, oh no, I want to ride on the scooter. And then another time I'd come up by car and I was walking with my cane to the entrance of the school. And there was a young girl who was, from one of the special education classrooms. I think she had probably a developmental disability as well as some physical disabilities. And she came over to me and she said, why are you using that cane? And I said, well, you know, my legs are a bit wobbly. They don't work that well. And she said, oh, okay. Whereas you can see all of the other parents, as I'd started to use more mobility devices, like you could see them like side-eyeing me. Like they didn't, nobody wanted to come up and talk to me and just straight out ask. I had, you know, the group of friends that knew what was going on, but you could see all the sort of, the acquaintance parents, the ones who had kids in the same classes, but you weren't really friendly with. You could see them kind of giving me the side eye. Whereas the kids were like, hey, you know, why'd you use a cane? And I'm like, my legs don't work that well. And they're like, oh, okay. So I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Yeah. How about in terms of like help out in the public? So, you know, to have that bit of independence, if you're able to say, take a transit van and go to the grocery store for a few items with Charlie.
Yeah.
Would your preference be for someone to offer you help if you know, if they can see you might not be able to reach something? Is that, like, where do you land on offering help and asking for help?
It's a really fine line. Obviously, if I'm looking up at the top shelf and there's no way I can get that thing, I'd rather somebody just said, can I help you? I think the important thing is, and there's a lot of discussion about this in the disability community, is rather than just saying, I'll get that, or the worst one is for people in manual chairs, somebody will just get up and push them somewhere, you know. You wouldn't do that to somebody's physical body, so you shouldn't do it to their chair. But so I think the best thing you can do is say, how can I help you? Or is there anything I can help you with? Not barging in and just grabbing the thing off the shelf.
Do you want the SpaghettiOs?
Yeah.
Because I think that...
Yeah, making sure you're giving the person with the disability the agency. You're not taking over from them. You're just like if you saw somebody... else that was having some kind of trouble, you wouldn't just go up and do something for them. You would say, do you need some help or can I help you? But and if they,
like,
if
you
they
said at the beginning of your disability, you were able to walk some, so you know, just because someone is in some sort of a device doesn't mean they can't walk or stand, but you don't know.
I think one thing that comes up a lot, there's a meme that goes around on Facebook or whatever often, is a picture of a woman in a wheelchair and she stands up to get something off the shelf in a store. And I think there's this misnomer for people that are not in the disabled community that think just because you use a chair, you can't walk. And the vast majority of people who use wheelchairs are actually what they call ambulatory users. So they can stand and walk at least somewhat. They just, you know, the wheelchair allows them to go further distances or...
Get through the store.
I'm gonna have to make a note to remember, but a little girl that I used to nanny for last year got diagnosed with a condition that somehow what it does is it affects her in a way where she just gets fatigued really quickly from like being on her feet or walking around, and so she uses a wheelchair now, and she actually, like, she's one of the brightest little kids I've ever met, so, you know, she just like didn't let it stop her or anything like that, but she even like found a character from, I want to say, Wreck-It Ralph, to be for Halloween, so that her wheelchair was the car part of the costume for her costume for Halloween. But you know, it's not that she can't walk; it's that the condition she has makes it so that she, like, just can't sustain the energy to be mobile like a normal kid her age.
Yeah, I think one thing that's really the phrase wheelchair bound, that, because for the vast majority of people, the wheelchair is their freedom. You know, it took me a long time to accept that I needed to use a wheelchair. And suddenly I'm like, hey, I can do these things. Whereas before I was always like, okay, if there's a parking spot right outside that store or that restaurant, I know I can get in and get out again. But if there's no parking spot there and we have to park it, you know, farther away or whatever, then we can't do that. Then I started using the chair and I'm like, okay, I can get wherever I need to go. I don't have to limit myself. So for most people, the wheelchair is, you know, freedom. You're not wheelchair bound. It's not holding you back.
The stuff you guys sent out, it's wheelchair user?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Naomi, if I remember, which is always the question, when you came for your interview, you didn't have your college yet.
No.
Right? It was your manual, and it was coming. And I remember when you got the college chair, how much you told me it just increased your freedom. Mm-hmm. Vividly remember that.
Yeah, if I hadn't had the power chair, I wouldn't have been able to do my training here, because I wouldn't have been able to get from the, you know, because a manual chair, especially if you haven't, you know, remember, MS means you get fatigued very quickly all over your body. Pushing a manual chair is very, you know, these guys that do like wheelchair sports, whatever, they have incredible upper body strength. Mm-hmm. You know, your shoulders are like, you know, it's hard work pushing a wheelchair. I can do it. I use a manual chair in the house just because this is a bit cumbersome in our small Cape style house. But getting out the house, I don't even have the strength to get it up the ADA compliant ramp. You know, it's hard to do it. So, yeah.
Because I thought of you. There's a gentleman that we're working with who really fighting going into a power chair, and mm-hmm. part of me thinks I get it, but part of me remembered you, and I thought, mm-hmm. no, there might be more freedom for you, but it's...
I'll say that my insurance bought me one of these full-size, chunky 300-pound chairs. That sits in the corner of our house, and it's completely useless because it barely fits through our front door. I bought this one myself. Insurance don't pay for these kind of folding chairs. It folds up and fits in the back of the car. Otherwise, we would have needed to buy a wheelchair man, which are $60,000 or whatever. So I think that was, I wouldn't have really been using a power chair regularly if I hadn't got this one.
It is very streamlined and,
yeah.
you know, yeah. like you said, foldable. And
one of the underlying things to comment on an earlier question, so saying about how the family coped, it's only because we are financially well off. And we are lucky that we both got a long time ago, like, you know,
long-term disability.
That, you know, we can live as we do and mm-hmm. get by things like this and the various other like disability aids that we've gone through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we financially we're very privileged, which means that. For instance, when I had to stop working, it was not a financial decision because of the long-term disability coverage we had through my work, through Social Security disability, and through a private policy we had. My income's the same as it was. For many people, you know, this chair costs $3,000. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not something most people can manage to fit into their budget. And, you know, the vast majority of people with disabilities are living on low and fixed incomes.
So that answers part of my question. I was going to ask you about your work, because in theory, your work you could do from home to some extent, maybe depend, or maybe with a different organization.
The teaching part is really yeah. hard to do. You know, yeah. physics, we do a lot of hands-on labs.
Also, this was before.
Yeah, I mean, I stopped right. work before the pandemic. But for me, I was a college professor. Because of the way my disability was progressing, it was getting harder for me to really be able to stand up in front of a class for 3+ hours a day and those things. And I was reaching the point where I was coming up for the equivalent of tenure at Wentworth. I suspected I wasn't going to get it because of the amount of time that and my disability had caused me to have to take off work. Mm. So I made a choice. I left at that point while I was still on the staff, which meant I qualified for their long-term disability coverage. If I'd have stayed on, not got tenure, they could have just fired me, correct. And then I wouldn't have got that.
Yeah.
And obviously, the long-term disability or something that we're on is, you know, one of those ones, you know, it's essentially some level of final salary, so you don't want to go into part-time.
Yeah.
Less money then, it's one of those stupid decisions.
Yeah, that was the thing. It was all or nothing, because if I'd have gone to part-time work, then I wouldn't have got the, you know, a lot of the long-term disability insurance companies basically say, if you can work part-time, you can obviously work full-time. So if you can do any work, then you can, you don't
so it's sort of
qualify.
All
yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. It's.
So I still do a little bit of tutoring at home under the table, but it's not worth it to me to even try to work part-time, even though I probably could. Mm-hmm. You know, hear all these horror stories of these PIs going around taking photographs of, you know, people on disability going into, you know, doing whatever they're doing. But I still...
You'd like to try and catch them... like cheating the system?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
I
don't know how common it is, really, but you hear that these stories make the papers every now and again. And then I still, every 6 months, they call me up and I have to send new medical documents saying, yes, I'm still disabled.
I'm not out running. And...
Yeah. And, I go to my doctor every time and we laugh about it because it's like you have to fill out this form with, you know, can you lift 30 pounds? Can you walk half a block? Can you do... It's like I couldn't 6 months ago. I mean, I know there are people that have, say, an injury that they recover from, but they should recognize that, you know, just from the diagnosis that they don't need to be following up on me quite so often.
Yeah. There are certain medical conditions that... just not going to recover.
Mm-hmm. It's progressive. It's only going to get worse.
Any other questions? We so appreciate you. I mean, it's, you know, this is your personal story, and we were discussing it as a DEI team. You know, just because we work at Needs doesn't mean we understand and can be, you know, in your mm-hmm. shoes, so to speak. So I think for us, it's good to understand better what our clients go through and why they come to us, you know. And we appreciate your yes. perspective and your vantage point because it helps all of us do what we do and appreciate why you need us, you know. That's why we're here.
Just like I said, everyone with MS is different. Everyone with a disability is different. So This is my story, and while a lot of my experiences are probably similar to other people's, it doesn't mean that I claim to speak for anyone else but myself.
Mm-hmm. I'd also say that whilst Naomi has discussed the people's stupid and idiotic views and things they do, I personally have not been immune to that before, you know, having to deal with someone with all this stuff. So.
Yeah, I mean... Like I was saying with our kids going around checking for the disabled placards in the cars, you know, there's plenty of things that you look back and, like, now everywhere we go, we're checking, has it got a ramp? Or, you know, we wouldn't have even thought of those things before.
My husband is also disabled, although he has some of the mobility, he also needs a chair. And I can just say almost everything you said, we experience it, just to reinforce that there's nothing unique about Naomi at all, even to the point of people coming up and pushing his chair and, you know, talking to me instead of talking to him. Like, and I remember...
Well, that's interesting that it's more about the person in the chair rather than the sex thing. So.
Yes. Although I do think, like, I was listening closely and thinking, I do think you probably experience a little more of that because you're a woman. My husband's a big, you know, strong-looking guy, although he kind of isn't. I think he maybe gets a little bit less of that. Like, one thing I don't know if you notice, you may not see this, but I don't know what kind of car you have, but when he pulls into a handicapped spot, and they wait to see when he gets out of the car. When he gets out of the car with his crutches and pulls his wheelchair out of the car, it's like, all right,
yeah,
like, stop that. Because you have no idea.
Yeah, you're too young to be disabled.
Yes, absolutely, yes. What's your disability? They want you to prove it. They want you to prove that you're really disabled. Also, my husband, although he ultimately had weight loss surgery and has lost weight, he's a really big guy, and that has to do in part with his disability, like in part it's genetic, but it's in part, like, he's super sedentary, and he has tried, he loves to swim,
He has tried to join facilities with pools, and the locker rooms are so freaking inaccessible. It's so impossible for him because they're gyms and they're designed for jocks. And even though they may have technically an accessible toilet or whatever, it's so freaking hard for him to get in and out of the locker room, to change in and out of his stuff, to take a shower, and then to get to the pool, let alone get in the pool. And that, you know, it never works. He's gone once. Every time he's tried it, he's gone once and been like, yeah, never mind. So anyway, he's a big guy. And lots of people seem to use his wheelchair because he's obese. And they are really judging. They're judgmental. Generally, oh my God, are people judgmental when they think you don't really need a chair. You don't deserve to have a disability. It's amazing the attitudes that we have.
Well, it's kind of like you said, you know, you were younger and, you know, people are kind of like, why do you have a disability? You're young. Like, young people can't get disabilities.
Yeah.
But have you found, you both seem like pretty funny people. Have you found ways to sort of educate people and, you know, counter their perception that may be completely wrong without, you know, having a chip on your shoulder every time you encounter someone? It seems like that'd be a tough balance.
The thing is, we're English.
I hadn't noticed.
And not only are we English, but we're fairly antisocial. So, you know, I personally, you know, we don't have a huge, social grouping that we are. And the last couple of years, obviously, we've not been doing anything, sort of thing. So, I don't know. Maybe I'm on your toes here, maybe, but
I think. The bottom line is, if we're just out to have a nice evening meal or whatever, we shouldn't be spending it educating other people. Yeah. We should, yeah. You know, mm-hmm. If we want to sit around and have a few beers or whatever, it's nobody else's business. So, but, mm-hmm. You know, some days I feel like engaging, other days I won't. Like, you know, when we were leaving the theater and I just turned around and I was so angry, I said, I'm not a toddler, mm-hmm. You know. That was just an angry retort, whereas, you know, other times, if I'd been in a better mood or whatever, I might have said, you know, excuse me, would you touch somebody else on the head, a fully grown adult, or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm a pretty pragmatic person, so I generally don't let it get to me. I just get on with my life. And I think going back to when people talk to Doug over my head, the funniest thing is that in our house, I am 100% the household manager. I'm the one that knows what's going on with our finances. I do all the grocery shopping. I do it online. And, you know, hot vacation planning. There was a meme that went, I saw the other week, where it's like, you know, one partner is like, you've got the passports, got the tickets, got, you know, other partner, where are we going again?
And when are we going?
Yeah. Well, that is 100% us. So yeah. So people looking at Doug for an answer, he most likely wouldn't have a clue anyway.
Tell me when to fire up the car.
Yeah.
When you make those phone calls to restaurants and to hotels that they generally don't even know or answer accurately?
Yeah. You have to be very specific. I've had, in cases, have people go to the hotel room and photograph the bathroom. Mm.
Yep. I've had people measure doors.
I've gone to a hotel and they've said, oh, room blah, blah, blah is accessible. You go up to the room and you find it's not. There's no grab. Minimum is I need to be able to use the toilet. So I need grab bars there. If we're only staying a night, I can get away without taking a shower or whatever. But if there's no grab bars around the toilet, then there is no way I can use that bathroom. So I'll go back down and say, that room's not accessible. They'll be like, oh, isn't it? It says it on our, you know, whatever.
List.
So, but yeah, so it's, as I said, it takes all the spontaneity out of things. But before... I mean, kids do that a bit too, but before we had kids, I mean, a really good trip that Doug and I took, we flew to San Francisco and we had a rental car booked and we had a hotel booked for the first night. And the rest of that trip, we was just drove up the California coast mm-hmm. and we like find a motel in each city. Mm-hmm. Where have we got to? Oh, this looks like a nice place. We'll stay here a couple of nights or whatever. And we, you know, that was how we used to vacation. We can't do that anymore. We have to make sure every hotel room is booked with the accessible room, because if you get there and there's not one available, you're stuck.
Yeah, so it's the, I think we just went to a family restaurant Philip. In Philadelphia, is it? No, just Philadelphia,
sorry. The hotel.
We went to a restaurant and sort of phoned up and said, you know, check that they're accessible. We got that. And you couldn't actually get in because there was no drop curve.
So even if the restaurant itself was accessible, we couldn't get from the parking lot level to the sidewalk level.
I called a restaurant, the mall once, and asked if they were accessible. And the woman paused for a minute. She said, oh, yeah, just go around to the kitchen. The guys will carry them up. Yeah. Or not.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you can't just say, are you accessible? You have to be very specific. Like, you know, do you have high top and booth seating? Do you have regular tables? What kind of bathroom do you have? You know, everything. Yeah, I mean,
if you're visually impaired, it's a very different thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, there is a big chasm between being ADA compliant and being a truly accessible, welcoming space. For instance, my son's middle school, it was built before the ADA, but it has an elevator. Well, because it's two separate buildings that were built next to one another, the floors don't match up. So you go in like floor level one on one building and you come out on level three on the other building. So you get in this elevator and you've already got no clue where you're going anyway. But to get to the elevator, you have to go in the building, go all the way to the back, sort of do three sides of a square, go up in the elevator, and then probably come back around three sides of a square to where you were getting to. If you go up the stairs are right inside the front door. So that building is ADA compliant, but it's not really accessible truly, because, you know, if you were somebody that struggled to walk, you were walking three times as far as everybody else just to get to the elevator. So, yeah, I think, you know, obviously your facilities are awesome because you've designed them with people with disabilities in mind, and they're a lot better than just ADA compliant, but too many people think ADA compliant is enough. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really not.
Even for us, like with fundraising events, I mean, you just get dressed as an example. Whatever church from umpteen many years ago, and it's like wooden pew boxes, and it's like, okay, it's great if we're having a fundraising event and we're going to invite people, but clients are also going to attend. We're going to invite clients to attend, and now we're going to put 200 people with all of these obstacles in the way, and just because it's compliant doesn't mean that it's friendly. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that there is a big difference. And now where we are, it's like, no, it's a completely open floor plan, and let's think about where we're putting the table so that people.
Yeah, I mean, in general, compliant means you can get in the front door.
It's kind of minimally there.
Yeah. Which is still awesome. I think, while I complain about it, the ADA is an incredible piece of legislation. Nothing like that exists anywhere else in the world. I pretty much can't go back to the UK anymore because I cannot get into anywhere.
How long have you lived here?
I moved in the middle of 1999.
Yeah, 2000.
I moved in the middle of 1999.
End
that
of two.
Was Hawaii.
Yeah, and then the end of 2000, I came out to Massachusetts.
I haven't been there, so I don't know if this is true, but I would just throw out that apparently Spain has a reputation for a tremendous commitment to accessibility, and I've actually looked at vacationing there.
someone begs to
know. Interesting.
Makes like,
it probably depends on the part of Spain, because I know, for instance, a lot of Northern Europeans retire to the south of Spain along the Mediterranean coast and things. So those parts of Spain are probably quite accessible because there's a lot of older retired people there.
My wife is from Spain, so I spend a lot of time there. And that is, while that is probably true, it's probably true. I can tell you that if you're vacationing there, you're probably wanting to go to all of the sites and
yeah.
tell you that is not the case, actually. Mm-hmm. And their subway system, like you had mentioned, is pretty much spot on. There's stairs within each different, change and stuff. Like, it's just not, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, older buildings and historical buildings are tougher, but the ADA, particularly any of the national parks, are really, they've done incredible jobs to make them available for people with disabilities to get at least a major part of all the experiences. There's some parts where it's just not possible because of the historical or natural preservation, but they're pretty good. You can do the entire south rim of the Grand Canyon. It's all a paved path.
Wow, that's cool.
It's 10 miles long, if you want to go that far. We did it, we did it by car. So, by about the third lookout, our kids were saying, not more rocks, this is the same as the last one.
That's then, kids for you.
Then we got to the next lookout, and there was this Australian family with kids similar age, and these two teenage boy and girl got out and said almost the exact same thing. We're like, thank more God rocks. It's not just our kids.
It's just
you
kids.
And
Charlie then?
No, that was spring of 2015, I think, when I did the Grand Canyon. We did Las Vegas and with Charlie and this February after we got him. Not because we wanted to see Las Vegas. We spent zero time in the city, but there's a lot of really good national and state parks there. So we did like the Red Rocks Canyon and the Valley of Fire. And we went to Death Valley with him. We got a picture of him in Badwater Basin, which is the lowest point, which in February is a pretty comfortable 80-something degrees. So it was... And then staying there after in the Death Valley National Park after dark and seeing just the sky there, it's incredible. Wow. Especially for Doug and I as astrophysicists who grew up in, did most of our astrophysics in the UK, where you're lucky if you actually get a non-cloudy night.
Well, we want to thank you so much for coming, and please stay if you can and talk more with Naomi, but... Thank you for taking the time to come out
thank
today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Fun from Needs.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Yeah. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And I'm not sure who was happier to be here, me or Charlie.
He was pretty happy. Yeah. He's like, it's like home. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Grab a cookie if you didn't get one. Thanks, Melissa, for making the cookies.
Yeah,
this is awesome. Good representation from the good, for sure. I think ours is 100% too. There's only three of us, so.
Well,
I know, right?
Better be here.
I wonder what's going on. Oh, I guess we can stop this. I'll just keep it going.